Have you or someone in your family ever suffered from stress, anxiety? What about depression or substance abuse or addiction? Well, you're not the only one out there. Welcome to The Full Story on WSHU and online at WSHU.org. I'm Ron Ropiak. I hope you had a nice, calm, relaxing weekend. And I think this is fair to say. Everyone whom I have known well in my life, at some point, they need a helping hand. Life can be extremely stressful and difficult, and sometimes having a qualified guide can help. Mental health is our topic today, and we're going to talk about it starting at the youngest age. And for that, we're bringing in Dr. Victor Fornari. He's professor of psychiatry and pediatrics at the Zucker School of Medicine at Hofstra Northwell, and the director of the Division of Child and Adolescent Psychiatry, Department of Psychiatry, at the Zucker Hillside Hospital and Cohen's Children's Medical Center. Welcome, Doctor. Thanks for being with us today.
Thank you for having me.
I have to ask, you have an extremely stressful job. How do you handle it?
Well, I tell all my colleagues we have to begin the day with a mindful moment and teach our colleagues as well as our patients and their families that they all have to learn how to manage stress so that we can cope with everything that we need to do.
I like that, a mindful moment. Do you do that just out of curiosity when you first wake up?
No, actually, I wait till I get to my office and I have a gong that was given to me as a gift by a colleague, and you can download an app with from the App Store of a variety of mindfulness exercises that can be 1 minute, 2 minutes, and just start the day with a mindful moment. And then throughout the day, if you're feeling particularly stressed, you might say, I think it's time for a mindful moment. And we've incorporated some mindfulness exercises into our team meetings to help colleagues to try to relax, into some of the clinical services to help teach patients and their families about the importance of learning how to relax and self-regulate. So I think mindfulness has become a very important aspect of self-care for everyone.
Well, I think that's great. And I could see us having a gong right here in the studio in the very near future. But does it work with kids? You work with kids. I read a report the other day that said that 1 in 6 American kids has a mental health disorder. Is that number accurate?
Yes. In fact, it might be even 1 in 5. About 18% of youth will meet criteria for at least one psychiatric disorder before the age of 18. And that's not just the U.S. That's worldwide. So those figures really have been replicated throughout the world. And so we recognize that these are very prevalent health problems and that most mental health problems need to be viewed as brain diseases in the same way that we would view other kinds of health problems as diseases of the different organ systems from which they emanate. And I think we recognize that most of them are biologically based and they need to be identified, evaluated, and treated.
I'd like to get to the biological aspect in a moment, but I have to ask, are some areas, and now I'm just talking about the United States, are some areas of the country better or worse? Because, again, I was reading that Long Island, specifically, is higher. Is that accurate?
Well, in general, I would say that the base rate of psychiatric problems in kids is similar throughout the country. There may be certain kinds of problems that may be related to certain conditions or environmental stressors that are unique to specific regions. But I don't have any data to say that the rate of mental health problems on Long Island is higher than other parts of this country. We do know that stresses can put people at increased risk. And so having multiple adverse childhood experiences puts kids at higher risk for certain kinds of emotional conditions. And we certainly recognize the impact of stress and toxic stress on children.
So if we can go back to what you were just talking about a moment ago, you said it was mostly biological. Can it be environmental? If it runs in a family, is the child more likely to come down with some type of, would you use the word disorder?
So I think what we need to recognize is that each of us is the unfolding of our genes. And we have many genes which will never get expressed, but they simply are there as predisposing factors that may become expressed. And so the impact of environmental stressors on our genes is that if we have a predisposition as well as environmental stress that can be in a variety of different kinds of life experiences, it may bring out a genetic predisposition. So I think it is the interplay of genes and environment.
Are families more likely nowadays in the last decade, two decades or so, to seek treatment as opposed to what may have happened, let's say, back in the 60s, 70s, 80s?
Well, I think there's a greater awareness about the identification of serious emotional disturbances. And certainly for children, schools are wonderful resources to help identify kids who may have a variety of different mental health or behavioral health conditions. And so I think families, even though there may be a certain amount of reluctance or resistance to accept it, I think families are more willing today to seek treatment because they recognize the impact of these behavioral health, mental health problems on their children.
Do some of us, though, still have a tendency to look away, to pretend almost that it's not occurring because we think we can't do anything? It's too difficult to treat.
Well, look, there remains enormous stigma associated with psychiatric conditions and seeking psychiatric care, and hopefully education about the importance of recognizing the identification of psychiatric disorders and the importance of seeking treatment will minimize that stigma. But it's something that we continue to have to address as we face the fact that in many communities and in many cultures, there still remains enormous stigma against psychiatric illness and psychiatric treatment.
How would you compare the United States to other countries? And is there a model, a country somewhere around the globe that you admire what they're doing?
Well, I think we recognize that part of the challenge in our country is the limit access to health care. And the truth is that the countries around the globe that really have been leaders in demonstrating the importance of providing access to health care and mental health care for all are countries that recognize that these services should be available for everyone. And so I think if we look to some of the Western European and Scandinavian countries, I believe they have models of systems of care that really attempt to provide access to mental health care for all. And so although we are doing everything we can to try to create systems of care to reach those at risk and who require the treatment, we know that a very large percentage of individuals who suffer from mental diseases do not have access to mental health care.
I don't know if you remember, there was that old oil filter commercial, and the line in the commercial was pay me now or pay me later. And I'm sitting here thinking, well, you could do the treatment when someone is, you could do the treatment possibly when someone is a little bit younger, or you can possibly do it when they're a little bit older. And what's better to do?
Well, there's no question that early identification and intervention for children and adolescents is far superior. We really want to maximize helping each child reach their full potential. So whether they're suffering from anxiety, depression, a disruptive behavior disorder, whatever the mental health problem might be, the earlier that it's identified, treated, the better the outcome, because they'll be able to reach their fullest potential academically, socially, with the least interference in functioning.
And finally, we're almost out of time, but from what you're seeing in our region, for New York and possibly Connecticut too, if you follow that, are legislators more understanding nowadays? Are you encouraged by what you're seeing on the legislative front?
Yes, I think there's a greater awareness that psychiatric problems are health problems and that we need to have access for all health problems for everyone. And there are greater awareness of parity, that mental illness should be reimbursed on par with other health problems. And so it is encouraging to know that the direction is to recognize the importance of addressing behavioral health and psychiatric illness, because without there is no health if you don't have mental health, because the fact is that when someone's suffering from mental health, it interferes with their capacity to function. So I am feeling optimistic that legislators are aware of the importance of having mental health services on par with all health services, and we have to continue to work towards advocacy for access to care for all.
Doctor, if someone is listening to this program right now and they're still on the fence about seeking treatment with the 30 seconds that we have left, what would you say to convince them?
I would say please speak to your primary care physician. That's the person I hope you have a relationship with. They can guide you to the appropriate care for whatever your mental health concern is, whether it's anxiety, depression, or any other mental health problem. And I believe that your primary care doctor can be your advocate and support to get you the proper psychiatric care that you may benefit from.
Dr. Victor Fornari, professor of psychiatry and pediatrics at the Zucker School of Medicine at Hofstra Northwell. Doctor, thank you. We appreciate your time.
Thank you.
We all know what a great job first responders and those in the ER do when it comes to physical first aid. They're lifesavers. They save our lives. But what about first aid when it comes to mental health? The Association for Mental Health and Wellness is a nonprofit based out of Ronkonkoma. They recently received a $375,000 grant to provide mental health first aid training to Long Islanders over the next few years. I believe the number is around 2,000 or so. Now, we have two guests to talk about this. Sandra Wodrego, I apologize about that. Sandra Hopkins Wodrego is project director of MH Strong Training Project for the Association for Mental Health and Wellness. And Tara Larkins Fredericks is director of special projects for the association. Sandra, Tara, thanks for being here.
Hi, thank you so much for having us.
It's good of you to take the time. Sandra, I was reading in Newsday just the other day that the Long Island region suffers from disproportionately high rates of serious mental health conditions. Is that accurate? Is that one of the reasons why what you're doing is so important?
Yes, that is accurate. And Long Island does have to deal with a lot of mental illness from specific communities. And that is why we're doing the work to promote the mental wellness.
Can I ask?
And there have been specific groups that have been included in our grant, and it's youth at risk for gang violence, veterans and their families, and then also public safety law enforcement.
Can I ask, do you have any reasons why it is higher?
I'm not sure of what the reasons are, but I think mental illness is something that is not discussed, a great deal. And now with the numbers and the ability now that we're able to have more discussion, that information is coming out more about the impact of mental illness.
Tara, the doctor, and I were talking in the previous segment saying that things possibly have changed over the last few decades. We're more than, I won't say more than willing, but we are more willing to speak about it nowadays, aren't we?
I think that the stigma around mental health issues has absolutely decreased, and so we're finding more people connecting to their personal stories and being willing to kind of share and put themselves out there. However, we don't want to overlook the fact that although roughly 20% of the population or one in five individuals suffers with a mental health disorder or a mental health problem in any given year, people are very slow and very apprehensive to seek out treatment, and often there's a delay of years before they're really, able to address the problem and connect with resources.
Interesting. So tell me, how do you train people to give them a better understanding, or at least a basic understanding, of the mental health issues that many face?
Well, the Mental Health First Aid is a project that was developed by brought over to the United States, actually, from Australia by the National Council for Behavioral Health. And really, it has a five-step action plan known as ALGI, which includes assessing for risk, respectfully listening, supporting the individual who is in crisis or experiencing a mental health problem, and then identifying appropriate professional help and other supports to help to link them to. So it's an 8-hour training, and Sandra can speak a little bit more about the details of it, but you have instructors who have been trained to be an instructor for either the adult module or the youth module or both. And you come in and you're able to learn about mental health, learn about the stigma related to mental health, learn about some specific disorders, warning signs, and then really look at how do you provide support to somebody in that situation or who you think might be struggling.
Sandra, this is an 8-hour class?
Yes. For the youth, though, we do have a 6-hour class for people who work in the school districts because of different rules that they have to follow, union rules. But the veterans class is 8 hours, and also the law enforcement safety, public safety, they're also, it's also 8 hours. But we also do have an 8-hour youth training for people who are not working in the school districts.
The reason I ask about 8 hours is because when I first heard about it and I was reading about it, I was thinking this sounds great, but then you hear about all the different aspects of what you have to study and know about, and it seems that while 8 hours is great, you could probably go the full week.
I think you absolutely could go a full week to kind of get all of this information in, but the training does a tremendous job at not only providing this information, having the participants walk away with great resources, including their participant manual, which is chock full of information, resources that they can access in the community, links to hotlines and websites that they can utilize in providing mental health first aid. And it's also really a hands-on training. So when they get in there, they're working in groups. We're doing a lot of role-playing so that they can really practice not only, you know, learning these strategies, but practice implementing them and applying them to potential real-life situations.
Sandra, give me some of the role-playing that you go through. Give me an example, please.
So in the youth training, what we're doing is, in that training, there are situations that are created where an adolescent is going through and developing a mental illness. So as we're going through the training, as we're learning the steps of the action plan, then some of the breakout exercises are, how would you approach this youth? The first step. And then as their situation increases to a crisis, as we're going along in the training, the last would be like the crisis situation and then how you would apply that five-step action plan to help the adolescent and then to connect them with the mental health resources that they may need.
Tara, I'm especially interested in the teenage aspect of this because talking with other parents, many times I've heard there's really no problem here because that's just a teenager being a teenager.
Right, and the youth mental health module is actually one of the sections is devoted to really understanding the difference between an emerging or a potential mental health problem and typical adolescence, because we don't want to assume that every time our young person is having a bad day or being emotional or experiencing mood swings that, oh my goodness, they're developing a mental illness. But what we do want to do is recognize, all right, it seems like they're struggling a little bit more than they should be. And even if it's not the emergence of a mental illness, it could still be that it's a developing mental health problem. It could still be something that a young person needs additional support around, whether it's just the support of a mental health first aider who can step in, provide that person with some support, with some general information, just let them know somebody's here, or linking to other community resources, whether it's medical resources like seeing their doctor or linking to a psychiatrist or a therapist, or sometimes it's really just some self-help strategies so that they can get through that storm of adolescence.
Sandra, how can we sign up for this? Is it available for someone like me, or do you have to have a specific type of background or standing in the community?
No, the mental health first aid trainers are from a wide variety of backgrounds. And you can go on our website, themhstrong.org. As we're scheduling trainings, then you can sign up and register for the training, either youth or veterans, or the law enforcement is more specific to people who work in probation, the police department, you know, those types of areas. But as we're building the calendar, we will let people know the trainings that are open to other people who may work with youth, and also other agencies that may, you know, that work with veterans as well. And then if they're open to the public, then you can sign up. Or you can call me, and I can give you additional information on perhaps your organization or an organization setting up a training, and, you know, what the logistics are for that, and to give additional information on the grant that we receive from the Substance Abuse Mental Health Services Agency, that we would be able to, you know, set up trainings for the organizations as well.
Okay, you know what? If you want to give out your number, I don't mind that. Do you?
Oh, okay.
Go ahead.
Okay, through the Mental Health First, the Association for Mental Health and Wellness, my number, Sandra Hopkins with Drago, is 631-471-7242, extension 1334.
I'll give it again a little bit later on, or we could even put it on our Twitter page. I'm sorry, Tara, go ahead.
I was going to say, I think it's really important to let everybody out there know that mental health first aid is a training that was designed for communities. It's not for mental health providers. It's not specifically for any type of service provider. It's really about communities and engaging them and empowering them to have conversations and support each other in mental health and wellness. So anybody who's interested in a training, I really encourage you to reach out. Your role as a mental health first aider could be as a parent, as a friend, as a significant other. Really, there's no wrong person to take this training.
Ben-Tara, but it's one thing, right, to administer first aid, you know, to someone maybe who's been in a crash or something else has happened. They're in no position to turn down the aid. They're looking for help. But sometimes in the other situations, you have to convince someone that they need help, right? Mental assistance.
So if you're looking for somebody to engage into ongoing, you know, therapy or, see a mental health provider, then yes, sometimes it might take some convincing, but that's not the role of the mental health first aider. The role of the mental health first aider is really around engagement. It's around recognizing that somebody might be struggling with either in a crisis situation or in an emerging mental health problem, and provide them support. So engage them, tell them they're not alone, share some information, and sometimes that's all that we do as a mental health first aider.
Okay.
And
then convince them that there are other services available, or maybe even
You can let them know. Sometimes that's not what's needed for, any given situation. You know, sometimes when we're applying first aid, if we want to relate it back to physical first aid, sometimes really what it requires, you know, is a Band-Aid and a kiss. And sometimes it requires, we really need to get you to the doctor so that they can reset this bone. So as a mental health first aider, we're going to help you to differentiate, you know, when is this an opportunity for you to provide support and just give them some information, and when is it going to be a crisis situation that we have to intervene further. But it's not going to be making that assessment by yourself. There's lots of resources that you can tap into. And ultimately, the responsibility of the mental health first aider is only to recognize that somebody might be struggling and try to engage that person.
Sandra, how many mental health first aiders do you hope to train over the next year or so?
So over the life of our grant, which started in September of 2018, and it will end in 2021, we must, to meet the requirements of the grant, 2,120 people. So that's like roughly 706 people per year. And then it's about 24 trainings per year.
And what kind of a response have you received so far?
We have really received great response for the willingness for people to learn more about mental illness and then to go through the training. And the response has really been great. And then also the people who have gone through the trainings, they feel a wealth of knowledge and awareness once they've gone through the training. And then they are able to relate it to, as Tara was saying, not only, you know, for your work, but also for a family, you know, and understanding that mental illness can show up in families and, you know, in friends as well. And they are now equipped with a 5-step action plan that will help them. And so it's really been a very rewarding experience for the trainers as well for the people who have been the participants.
I was going to say, it sounds like it. Tara, is this a program that is specific to Long Island, or do you see it in other regions of the country?
Mental Health First Aid is actually an international program. So they have instructors in, I think, 30 countries currently and across the United States. And as I said, it's a really specific training. So the idea is that if you take a training with me or if you go across the country to California and take a training with one of those instructors, you're going to get a very similar experience. So you're going to have access to the same type of information and education. It's going to be structured the same. And that's really so that we can build this en masse community of individuals who understand mental health, who aren't afraid to talk about it, who feel prepared to engage somebody who might be struggling and really, you know, make a significant impact.
Sandra, where do you hope the program goes from here?
Well, I just want to continue to engage organizations and also, you know, communities, because I'm out in the communities as well, you know, reaching out to, you know, continue, helping them to get on board with the Mental Health First Aid. And it's just, you know, just getting to the communities of need, the underserved communities, and bringing this information and empowering people to be able to assist others who may be developing a mental illness or in a mental health crisis.
And once again, I'm going to give that phone number if you don't mind. It's, I believe I have it right, 631-471-7242, extension 1334. Did I get that right?
You got it right.
All right, 631-471-7242, extension 1334. Sandra Hopkins Wodrago. Did I get it right that time?
Yes. You really did a great job with my name, because most people can't. So.
Fantastic. I've been sitting here while you've been speaking, practicing silently, because I hate to mispronounce. But thank you, Sandra. I appreciate that. Tara Larkin Fredericks, Director of Special Projects. They're both with the Association for Mental Health and Wellness. I appreciate your time today. Thank you, and please come back in the future.
Thank you so much.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. If you would like to join in the conversation, you could email us. We're at tfs@wshu.org, tfs@wshu.org, or find us on Twitter. We're at Full Story WSHU. It is the Full Story on WSHU. One last break. We'll be right back. It's the Full Story on WSHU, and we continue our discussion about mental health issues in our region and how to treat them. Dr. Stephen Marins is the Harris Professor of Child Psychoanalysis and Director of the Childhood Violent Trauma Center at the Yale Child Study Center. Dr. Marins, welcome. Thanks for your time today.
Thank you.
Doctor, just so we can have some background, how do you define trauma?
Well, trauma is a special category of experience that where everybody knows what it feels like to be anxious. And, you know, the our heart rates go up, we feel sweaty, we have preoccupying thoughts, and it's not comfortable. But one of the things that anxiety does is it serves as a signal that that we're feeling threatened in some ways, and the threat can come from inside of our fantasies or from the external world. But in the traumatic situation, the threat is of a different order, and because it's of a different order, it changes the extent to which our minds and bodies respond, so that the very parts of the brain that usually allow us to assess information and make plans is compromised and sometimes offline in relationship to the part of our brain that is responsible for the chemistry of our emotions. So one can use a very simple example that, you know, if you're excited about going on a vacation but you're feeling anxious, you know, to take care of everything, what's the first thing people do? Or one of the first things is they make a list. Mm. And so they make a list, they're able to check things off, and they can feel the physical sensations, the experience of anxiety decrease. In the traumatic situation, we sometimes think of it as the convergence between our worst nightmare scenarios and reality in a way that we can't avoid, we can't protect ourselves, and we're overwhelmed. And so the usual capacity to draw on our organizational capacities, our planning, is knocked out of commission. And as a result, the feelings and the chemistry of our feelings go off the charts. And so the usual communication that keeps us feeling more or less in control is knocked out of commission. And there are certain circumstances where threats to the feeling of safety, the experience of fears about damage to our body, the fears about loss of love, about loss of control of impulses and thoughts and feelings, are ones that make people most vulnerable to traumatic dysregulation.
So it sounds from what you're saying that trauma is so severe that our brains simply don't function in a normal way. It's that old line, I'm not thinking right at the moment.
Exactly. And often when people are beyond the most acute experience of traumatic dysregulation, they can often will articulate, I can't think straight. And in fact, trauma has different phases, from the immediate response when confronted with the realization of worst nightmare scenarios to the intermediate experience, which we refer to as the peritraumatic phase, and then which can last up to 2 months. And then beyond that, when we start thinking about disorders like PTSD or anxiety disorders and depression, the good news is that by understanding these phases can help define ways of intervening so that people don't have to suffer as much, but also where we can help to interrupt the move from the peritraumatic experience, the acute and peritraumatic experience, and interrupt the trajectory towards longer-term disorders.
Now, there are so many aspects of this topic that I'd love to talk with you about, but because of lack of time today, and hopefully we can get you in here for a long program in the future, I want to talk with you about what you've been doing with the New Haven Police Department for, I think, from what I was reading, I think you've been doing this now for 3 decades. Can you tell us about your program?
Yeah. So one of the things that we know is that, and this is, again, the audience will recognize this, often when we're feeling in the least control of our lives and we're feeling the effects of that, and they're not pleasant effects, imagine the experience, that experience, and somebody comes up to you and says, how are you doing? Most people, the first reaction will be, I'm fine. You know, leave me alone, I'm fine. But in a traumatic situation, the turning away from the feelings and the awful experiences of helplessness actually serve a great disadvantage. It increases isolation and one is left alone with the symptomatic expression of the traumatic dysregulation. So we know that one of the best predictors for good or bad outcomes in terms of real experiences that are traumatic is the failure for people to even recognize that an individual has been traumatized. And the second predictor is whether or not there's adequate social support, which can first and foremost be from family members, friends, but also from mental health professionals. So we recognized a long time ago that clinicians were typically not going to know about, let alone see, the kids and families who were immediately impacted by potentially traumatic events. But there is a profession, a professional group that does see these kids and families, and that's the police. The police are responding on a daily basis to events that have the potential for being traumatically dysregulating. And if we could join forces, we might have an opportunity to, number one, better identify those kids and families who are impacted by potentially traumatic events, but also, when equipped, officers can play an enormously significant role in helping caregivers attend to the needs of their children, let alone recognize their own traumatic experience. And better equipped, police can actually help create some of the immediate stabilization that's so essential to initiating recovery. In tandem, when working together, our clinicians are on call 24/7, and we work together in responding acutely with our police partners to many cases. But we also do follow-up visits, joint follow-up visits, in which we can inform adult caregivers about the impact of events on themselves as well as their kids. And as a result of this work, we developed an early brief evidence-based intervention that can actually serve the purpose of helping to interrupt the trajectory from immediate post-traumatic symptoms and suffering to decreasing the likelihood of development of longer-term disorders.
Speaking of police, Lieutenant Renee Dominguez is with the New Haven Police Department. Lieutenant, thanks for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
Do members of the department go through special training for this, and how long does the training take?
In the academy, we do an initial training for the officers about the program and about ride-alongs and how to best work with our clinical partners when we have them and when we don't have them, and if we were going to be calling them if we needed them to come out or if we were just going to be making referrals. But recently we have the Yale Child Study Center has developed a additional program which kind of builds on what we've always been doing for all these years at the New Haven Police Department and recognizes the great need or the great influence that police officers have on scene initially before anybody else to be someone who can intervene early with kids going through traumatic events. That training is an eight-hour training one day, and it's really jam-packed full of a lot of great material to help the officers kind of do what they're already doing it, but just to make them recognize that, hey, you're doing this and you're doing a great job. Here are some more tools to help you. And we're able to kind of like answer any more question that has kind of come along during their training from the first time they had it. And then we also do some refreshers during our in-service training. We'll come in and we'll just kind of re-talk about it and bring up any challenges we've been having, any really good positive interactions that they've had with the community and some outcomes just so that they can feel validated that what they're doing really does matter.
Dr. Marins, you've been doing this for a few decades now. Has your program been used as a model by other cities around the U.S.?
Yes. Many years ago, the U.S. Department of Justice was very invested in this work, and so this model, the Child Development Community Policing Program, which is the partnership model that Lieutenant Dominguez was referring to, has been replicated in a number of communities around the country and abroad, and has been served as a model for variations on the theme, with the shared recognition that, as Lieutenant Dominguez was just stating, the tremendous and critical critical role that police officers can play in serving and protecting in this additional way that can so often initiate a recovery process.
I want to get another quick aspect to this story. Samantha Middlemass is with us in the studio. She is the Survivor Services Case Manager for SERI, not the thing that you talk to on your phone, but the Connecticut Institute for Refugees and Immigrants. I'm sure you get that all the time nowadays.
Yes, we do.
And it probably drives you crazy.
Absolutely.
You work with children from conflict regions around the world. They come to our region, Connecticut and New York. How many children are here now?
We have quite a high number of children. At this point, I would say up in the number of hundreds in the state of Connecticut alone. Over the years, that number has continued to increase. More than half of the world's refugees are currently comprised of children, and there's currently 65.6 million people displaced amongst the world from leaving conflict regions.
You've heard the doctor, you've heard the professor before talking about trauma and children in
yes.
this region. What special needs do these children have?
I would say that they have an array of special needs. Mental distress and trauma in children who are refugees and asylum seekers goes well beyond the conventional diagnosis of post-traumatic stress disorder. There's a lot of unique individual experiences that they face that are not the same as what the Western world has put into the diagnosis of post-traumatic stress disorder. Oftentimes, we have children who come here who are able to resettle. They're going into American classrooms, which in itself can be a traumatic experience. English is most likely their second language. They don't know how to communicate with their peers, and they're oftentimes mislabeled as having ADD or ADHD, when oftentimes what they're expressing in the classroom is signs of post-traumatic stress disorder.
Mm.
And what we have to keep in mind working with these children is that they haven't just experienced one trauma. They've had a lifetime of trauma and what we like to call a triple trauma. That's comprised of the trauma that took place in their country of origin, causing them to flee, the trauma of what happened during the journey of them arriving, and then what has then happened since getting to the United States.
Lieutenant, I'm assuming that you have run into this issue before in New Haven.
Yes.
And how do you train the officers? What special training do they possibly receive to help them cope with this?
I think we're a very open-minded city and police department as it is. So there is no specialized training within this program for refugees, but we do a lot of training specifically on children who may see trauma being a broader term, no matter it could mean different things to different children, and to recognizing that they're going through some sort of symptoms, and that's what's presenting to the officer on scene. So regardless of what the issue is, it's just what are they seeing, how can we best handle this, who can we reach out to be able to make them be productive members of society and to be able to recover and to move on, hopefully, from whatever it is that they're enduring.
Dr. Marins, yes, please go ahead.
Just to add to what Lieutenant Dominguez was saying. So, number one, I think it's really important to distinguish between trauma and PTSD. And I very much appreciate the special dimensions and particular external phenomena that can create traumatic dysregulation for refugee children. But most of the children we work with are not, they've not just experienced one thing. That in the studies of the interventions that we've developed, the average number of trauma types, that's not even how frequently they occur, is six. This ranges from separations, domestic violence exposure, sexual and physical abuse, et cetera. So this is not a kind of a one-time only. And clearly the kinds of experiences that your other guest was describing have great potential for creating traumatic dysregulation. And it's why, you know, particularly in the upsurge of attention to refugee children when they don't have the most basic support from family members, when they're separated from family members especially, we are compounding what is already an enormous burden. The good news is that we actually know something about how to put together the ingredients that can help support children's and families' recoveries. And unfortunately, too often we talk about trauma as though it's there's no escape from it. When we're able to take what we know and then put what we know into practices and policies and financial support for those practices and policies, children, regardless of the cause of their traumatic dysregulation, have a much greater chance of being able to recover.
Samantha, I'm already out of time, and I apologize for the shortness of our segment today. We'll get you back in the future.
Wonderful.
And that way we'll really get into it more. So with the minute we have left, what else can you tell us about the Connecticut Institute for Refugees and Immigrants?
I would say for those who are not familiar with us, we absolutely love to engage communities. In addition to working with refugees, we also work with asylum seekers, victims of trafficking, as well as unaccompanied minors. And we're hugely, hugely supported by volunteers. We currently have over 200 volunteers in our network and are constantly looking for more to get involved. So if anyone's interested in learning more about us, they are welcome to look us up online at CIRICT.org. And we would love to teach you more about the work that we're doing.
Dr. Marins, you're going to have the last word today, sir. With the minute that we have left, what can you tell us about the program and how those who are listening, if they're interested, could possibly participate?
Well, I think I'm going to make a more general statement based on what Samantha was saying, because I think that all the work that Siri is doing is actually an extraordinary example of what we mean when we talk about social supports as being a protective factor. And the work of Siri, as well as the work of the New Haven Department and police officers around the country who are engaged in this kind of work, with or without the specific mental health engagement, what they are offering to children and families by recognizing and addressing in all the ways that are needed to lighten the load, is already offering a beacon of hope. And that often one of the signal experiences of being traumatized is feeling both helpless and hopeless. And when we no longer ignore the suffering and potential lifelong damage of traumatic suffering, we are actually ushering in the possibility of recovery.
Dr. Marins, I'm sorry. I have to hold you there. Sorry, I've got 20 seconds left.
Yep.
Thank you, sir. I appreciate your time today. Dr. Stephen Marins, the Harris Professor of Childhood Psychoanalysis and Director of the Childhood Violent Trauma Center at the Yale Child Study Center, Lieutenant Renee Dominguez, the New Haven Police Department, Samantha Middlemass, Survivor Services Case Manager for the Connecticut Institute for Refugees and Immigrants. Thank you all.
Thank you.
I'm Ron Rubiak. That's it for our show today. Thanks to you for being part of The Full Story.